It's time for the chip race.
Hello and welcome to the chip race, now sponsored by the lovely people at Unibet Poker. I'm your host, David Lappin, alongside Darrow Carney, and boy, do we have a great show for you tonight. We have interviews with Unibet ambassador Diva Baltic Blonde Byrne and online legend John Spinks. I get put through my paces as Dara and Diva analyse a recent televised hand of mine. We've also got all the results from the online felds, plus the news from last weekend's Irish Open Festival. But first... 10 days ago, all eyes were on the Poker Night in America Twitch stream, as the poker world were treated to a grudge match between Kate Hall and Mike Dentale. A Twitter feud that it's fair to say got out of hand, ultimately disintegrated into heads up for roll smack talk, and with neither player willing to back down, a confrontation on the felt was inevitable. Believing this to be a must-see poker spectacle, PNIA producer Todd Anderson made sure there were TV cameras there to witness what turned out to be a grotesquely one-sided affair, Dentale bludgeoned by Hall, who definitely had the better hands, but who also had all the right moves to dispatch him. Todd, first of all, welcome to the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Todd, TV poker was central to the poker boom, and it's fair to say the mainstream popularity of the game has taken a hit in the last few years, with less poker on TV after Black Friday. You produce Poker Night in America, one of the few shows that still goes out on mainstream TV. Can you tell our European listeners who may not be familiar with the show a little bit about it and its format?
Sure. Poker Night in America was kind of my personal response to what I was seeing in poker. And that being, I've actually been producing poker since 2005. I started a show called the Heartland Poker Tour. It was kind of a grassroots opportunity for people, what I call regular players, not pros, but just recreational players to play on television. So at the end of, let's say get into like 2010, 2011, I was kind of just, I thought poker was stale. I used to love watching poker back in 2004. So Poker Night in America was sort of an attempt to bring back what I called fun to poker, using personalities that we've all, are familiar with. So Poker Night in America, the format is, it's a cash game. It's an invite only. It's very non-linear, so it's not like you have to watch one episode and another episode to kind of catch the drift. It's just like a snapshot into a cash game. And we bring on people like, you can name virtually any known poker player has played on the show, from Danny Negreanu, Antonio Esfandiari, Phil Hellmuth, Phil Locke, Jennifer Tilly, and so on and so on and so on. And we've produced over 150 episodes so far. And we've been on the air on CBS Sports Network since June of 2014. So we're coming up on our third year anniversary.
The show also streams on Twitch and routinely outperforms other poker streams on there in terms of viewing figures. Is the Twitch audience different from the TV one? And if so, how do you cater for both?
Well, that's a great question. And a lot of times people don't really factor that in, that there really are two separate audiences. The Twitch audience is, I would call, more of a hardcore poker audience. They don't want to see an edited version. I appreciate what you said about our stream. We've been working really hard to try to make that. The second part of your question was, who is watching the show on television? And I really believe that that's a totally different audience. They're much more, I would call, casual fans of poker. They may not even be players, really. I mean, they might even be just casual. They could be gaming fans. And that's the interesting thing about the show. We try to make it light and fun and not so much poker-centric. So we're trying to appeal to both sides, and we're kind of walking along that fence, and I think it's working.
Yeah, I think it looks very good on Twitch in comparison to a lot of the other Twitch streams that I watch. In terms of attracting new players to the live poker scene, I feel like Poker Night in America does a great job in trying to make poker visually appealing and fun. That said, I wasn't sure if the recent Kate Hall-Mike Dentale grudge heads-up match was in keeping with that ethos. I have a lot of female friends and a 25-year-old daughter who play a bit of online poker and in home games, but don't ever set foot in a casino because they see it as an intimidating male-dominated arena. As I watched the match, compelling as it was, I couldn't help but feel it would reinforce my daughter's views and dissuade her from giving live poker a chance. What's your feeling on this?
Well, as I think you and I connected, just simply because I responded to a tweet that you made, that I'm conflicted about this as well. Obviously, the match between Mike and Kate was born out of animosity. I mean, it was a real grudge match. I mean, there was no faking the feelings that these two had for one another. And, I think it runs parallel to what we're seeing in the United States in terms of politically.
Good point. I thought exactly the same thing. This looks like Trump versus Clinton all over again.
It is. It's Trump versus Clinton. It's liberal versus conservative. It's all those things, and it's all wrapped up into one. And you know, when the fight was going on, when they were going back and forth, and it looked like they were going to go play heads up, I was literally just reading it and going, do I want to be a part of this? Do I not want to be a part of this? I'm not really sure. So at the end of the day, it was going to happen anyway, and I'm like, well, we might as well film it. You know what? On some levels, it was very successful because a lot of people, you know, talked about it and watched it, and there was a lot of talk in the poker community about it. It generated a lot of heat. It generated a lot of publicity. It might have propelled our brand a little bit more. But the flip side is, you know, what's the downside? And you know, I'll give a lot of credit to Kate Hall. She actually reached out to me a few months ago, and she said, you know what? This thing is so silly. I'm so regretful of even getting myself into the situation, she said. She said, I would love for something good to come out of this. So she recommended that we have a charity component. So her wish was to have some donations made possible to the Committee to Protect Journalists. And so we did that. Like, we went out and contacted these charities, and we got a service involved that was able to take text messages and translate those into dollars. And we publicized the charities during the live stream. And we shot features for both of these charities, and we're going to highlight them in the show when they air. We're probably going to turn these shows around and have them on the air like by May. So we tried to put some positive spin, and you know, all credit to Kate. And then Mike too. Mike was jumped on board, and he was willing to play for a charity. So we tried to get some good to come out of it. You know, it, whether or not you feel like it was worth it, I guess it's definitely a subjective opinion.
I also felt that you picked absolutely the best two commentators you could have got for the job, apart from being like world class players, Doug Polk and Sean Deeb. The banter between them was really, really good. Actually, the banter between them was a lot better than the table talk between the participants.
Yeah, we really weren't sure how that was going to shake out. You know, it's one thing to fight in a social media environment, but when you actually face that person and you're sitting there next to that person, it people respond differently. And it was intense, man. Like, it was an intense thing. Like, they were both, I could tell. I mean, when we got there and they both showed up, I mean, Kate was like laser focused. Like, she didn't want to be distracted. She was all business. And Mike showed up. I've never seen him like that. Like, I didn't even recognize the guy when he walked in. I'm not even kidding. He walked in. He walked right past me, and I went, "Who's that? And why is he in this area?" And I had to like do a double take. And I looked at him like, "Oh my God, it's Mike." I mean, he's wearing a polo shirt. He's got his hair done. He's not wearing a hat. He's not wearing a tank top. I mean, you laugh, but I literally did not recognize him for a second there. And he was intense. He was all business. I think he was nervous. So it was an emotionally charged day. You know what, frankly, when it was all over, what I was really hoping, and call me an idealist or whatever, call me whatever you want to say about me. I try to think the best of people, but I was hoping, against hope, that when the match is over, they would shake hands and say, you know what, it was kind of silly what we did, and we don't have to, you know, hate each other with the white hot intensity that we do. That didn't happen. So again, whatever, it worked out the way it did, and I guess, you know, we didn't really solve anything, did we?
Yeah, no, I was very much hoping the same thing too. I mean, other sports have this tradition of sort of trash talking in before a fight or a boxing match or whatever. The two opponents will rip each other to shreds, but then once the fight is over, they sort of hug and make up, and it's like this catharsis and coming together. And I get what you say about it kind of reflects what's going on in society. I mean, I'm a European. I go across, the only time I play in America is I go across to the World Series every year, and I really enjoy playing in America with Americans, because poker is a truly mass mainstream thing in America, and you get people from every walk of life, every age, every political view, and yet it's always seemed to me, at least, that, you know, you can have very different people at the table and they can get on, and it's sad if that's, you know, if America is becoming more polarized to the point that people can't do that anymore.
It is sad. I don't like. It's just not as fun as it used to be, for those very reasons. And maybe things will settle down, but the way things are right now and the climate that we're in, I mean, it's like every day it's exhausting. Like every day, it's something. It's just it is craziness right now.
We're joined now by Diva Baruskait, or Diva Byrne, as she's better known these days. Diva, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
You are one of the new Unibet ambassadors. Congratulations on that appointment.
Thank you very much. I'm super chuffed. Really, really happy.
Well, as most of our listeners know, Dara and I are good friends. He's in the booth with me today. What they might know, however, is that we used to talk hands almost every single day. That was until you came along. So I guess my first question is, why do you think it's okay to steal another poker player's study partner off them?
A strong start from you, David. Very strong. I guess the question here is, I think Dara actually dropped you, right?
Is that? Oh.
I mean, the question would be, for Dara, why did you drop David and replace it with me?
I guess we'll throw it to Dara then. Why did you replace me?
I honestly don't remember, David. I can't imagine why Dive would be a better study partner than you.
You must have loved him too much.
David, we won't give anything away about your age, but I believe you were born in Lithuania when it was still part of the Soviet Union. What are your memories from that time, and particularly the period when Lithuania became independent?
Well, obviously, I was very, very young. We used to have Russian cartoons, and I used to watch them all the time when I was a kid. Russian channels, just in general, Russian TV, and that's how I learned my Russian. I never studied at school, and I still can speak a little bit, and I can understand a lot. Another thing that I remember is Independence Day itself. So I was quite young, but there were like military and lots of tanks on the streets and people protesting, and I watched that on TV when I was little. I remember all the family just sitting there having a meal and just, yeah, supporting, wow, like virtually everyone. So, yeah.
And what age were you when you came to England?
Sneaky. I was 17, actually.
And what was that like? Like 17 years old coming to a new country, was your English as good as it is now?
It wasn't, but I still could communicate quite well. It was a challenge initially. I used to cry a lot. I used to be homesick. But I think I'm quite an independent person. And after a few months or so, I kind of settled in, made friends, started in international language school, and made my way and got a part-time job. I used to work in the shoe shop, and used to work in a bar, and used to work in a nightclub. I tried all kinds of professions.
So at what point did poker come onto the horizon? I did a little bit of research for this and looked up your Hendon Mob, and I saw that your first cash was at the Palm Beach Casino in London in June 2011. You came second for 13K. Were you brand new, or had you been playing up until that point?
Before that, I played for quite a few months, I think 6 months or so. I played locally in London a lot, in daily tournaments, nightly ones, and also I've been playing online prior to my Palm Beach results for a couple of years or so, and had a few five-figure results there.
And Diva, I first met you at a European Nations event in Cyprus, maybe 2013. I'm not going to brag, actually I will brag, Ireland ended up winning the event, but you played so well that the English captain Barney Boatman left you in for almost the entire 2 days. Every team was required to have one female, but they could be subbed out at any time, and most of the other captains exercised that option with indecent haste. You ended up winning the individual prize for your seat. How did you end up playing on the English team? I remember the Lithuanian captain was pretty tilted about that.
Oh, thanks for compliments, guys. It's really nice to win the best seat of the tournament. How did I get on the English team? I've known Barney for quite a few years, and I think I could pass for an adopted English player myself if needed to, because I've been in England for so long before that game. Lithuanian captain didn't see in this way, but I don't remember him making the call to invite me and join the Lithuanian team, so he could not really say much post that.
Well, I hate to break up your little visit down memory lane on a trip that I never got to be on, because no Irish team captain wanted me to be on their team. How did you get to meet Barney? Barney's a bit of a legend, obviously, the British poker scene, one of the original Hendon mobsters. How did you make that connection?
Well, I've seen him a lot around playing around London games and in UK in general. But at the same time, we got sponsored by Genting Poker. So Barney was one of my teammates. It was a whole Hendon Mob group and me and Ellie, another girl. So we used to hang out a lot playing, you know, GPSs and going to the other local tours.
Another thing about you, Dive, is that you crush ladies' events really hard. You seem to cash pretty much every ladies' event you play. You make the final table half the time, and you've won a few. Most ladies I know don't actually enjoy the ladies-only events. What's your feeling on them, and what's the secret of your success?
Oh, thanks, Dara. I was very lucky to have like quite a lot of success in the ladies' events. In general, I do really enjoy ladies' events. I think I find them very friendly and intimate. The reason for that is because we don't usually get really big numbers. I think on average it's around 50 players.
Well, speaking of ladies' events, you recently played in and again crushed the Unibet Ladies Battle Royale in Bucharest, a tour stop of the Unibet Open from last December. What was that like as an experience? I know it was a bit of a mixed field. There were some gamers in the field and some very accomplished players too. What was it like playing against those girls?
It was really, really fun, actually, because we had the girls from different backgrounds, and you said, like, the girls with no poker experience and the girls with, like, very extensive poker experience. It was really interesting dynamic. My strategy for that was just, yeah, stay away of the really experienced girls. Try to get in the pots with the girls who don't really know what they're doing or if you're doing it correctly.
Are there any standout memorable hands from that tournament, apart from the final one, of course, which is always memorable?
I think the most interesting hand for me was actually when Luciana was on the button and she open jammed around 14 big blinds, and I was in small blind and I was playing about 25 bigs and I had King Jack off, and I knew instantly that it should be a reshove based on Luciana's wide range. I was kind of taking my time and I'm thinking, you know, like, shall I go with it or not? Because it was such a marginal close decision. And whilst I was doing that, obviously we still had big blind, Delia on my left, and she had me covered. She had 30 big blinds. So whilst I was taking my time to think about her hand, she actually gave a huge live sell. She basically made me fold the hand, which could have costed me my tournament life, because eventually I would have lost it because Delia had ace king, so I would have been out in fifth or sixth place if I went for that move. But the live tell basically, yes.
What was the live tell?
She asked how much out of turn and like started counting the whole chips, started counting it before even I asked how much.
Yeah, I generally tell people who are inexperienced live poker players, yeah, one of the things to do is not to look at your cards before your action is on you, so you can't give away that sort of information.
That's brilliant advice, Dara. I think it's one of you. Don't look at your cards. And another one is like, always make sure that it's your turn to act. Because I see time and time over again inexperienced players like going, I raise or call, and there is already someone all in, and may not even seen that play all in, and we have to call. And yeah. That's not what we wanted to do. So just make sure it's your turn and you're aware of what's the action previously.
Coming back to David's original question as to why I dropped him in pair with Dive. One of the huge things I find when I'm studying with Dive is that if I'm discussing a live hand, she asks me far more detailed questions about all of that physical stuff and, you know, how do they look and what have you seen them do in these spots before. And I actually find I learn a lot from Dive just on the whole sort of live play.
And I struggle to remember how the hand even played out. I usually get it wrong in the first place. So.
This is true as well. Yeah, Dive was always very clear on the starting hand and the run out.
Yeah, but it's amazing, you know, like to be able like to have Dara as a study buddy, such a, you know, experienced and such an awesome player. And
okay, that's enough of that. Now we move on to the next question. Dive, anyone who follows you on Twitter or Facebook,
No.
We don't need to talk about that. It's fine. Everybody knows.
Like continuously working at your game, that's the only way to beat the game, you know.
Okay.
It was a different topic, really, altogether.
Anyone who follows you at Baltic Blonde, I think, on Twitter, will know that you're a world traveler. You, particularly in the last few months, the pictures from beaches in the Maldives. Mountaintop photographs.
She's a hard life.
It's a very tough life. Obviously, incorporating poker into that, trying to find some venues that are great places to see, but also great poker destinations. What are you looking at over the next maybe 3 to 6 months?
So we got a friend's wedding in Barcelona in May. And then for poker-wise, we got Copenhagen coming up, which I'm super excited about. And it's a great food scene there and a great nightlife, I heard. And then I'm going to Lithuania for Easter to see my family. And we got beautiful traditions there, you know, like painting the eggs and like playing games on Easter day and going to church in the morning. So it'll be to see all of them. It'll be really nice to spend quality time together.
And Divey, obviously you've been announced as a Unibet ambassador, and that's an amazing signing for Unibet, I think. Looking forward, what are your remaining poker ambitions?
I would love to win one of the bigger games, just to come first in a big event such as Unibet Open or any other equal event. But I guess apart from that, every professional poker player's ambition in the end of the day is to win a bracelet at some point.
That's everybody except David, yeah.
Yeah, in the ladies' event, I think that's the most likely to happen because of the numbers and my experience. I think in general, my ambition going forward in poker is like to be a good ambassador and role model for the female poker players, especially obviously all poker players, but especially female players. I want to promote the game and I want to show that it's a great game to get involved and no one should be feeling intimidated.
Yeah, I also feel like that the Unibet events are particularly friendly. So it's a very good environment for ladies maybe to start playing.
Yeah, I agree. So far I played in Bucharest and London for Unibet Open Festivals. And I play some side events ranging from £100 to £300 and £500 and then main event £1,000. And all of them had more or less the same feel. People are there to have a good fun, to be friendly and interact and have a bunt and have a drink and just have an amazing time and holiday basically at the same time.
Diva, you're obviously a great role model for ladies in the game, top drawer player as well as a top drawer ambassador. As Dara said, Unibet are lucky to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Diva.
Thank you. It was great, guys.
Hello. Welcome to the news coming to you from my toilet. Hope everyone's well. Let's have a look at how everyone did this week. First of all, I think we should start with the Sunday Million. It was their 11th anniversary. Panama's Xavi 666 won $1.1 million in that competition. The field had 55,000 runners and generated a prize pool of $11.157 million. Xavi, congratulations on that. That is one ridiculous result for a Sunday evening, or a Monday morning, as I'm sure it actually was. Sam Grafton is feasting on Sundays lately. Last week, he won the Sunday Grand for $52,000. This week, he took down the high roller on Party Poker as well. Congratulations, Sam. Man is doing good. Aaron McBride, he won himself a Unibet Open Copenhagen package this Sunday. He got the token to play the event at Unibet Brighton for knocking out one of the ambassadors. So we look forward to seeing him at the event in Copenhagen at the end of May. But naturally, all eyes were on the Irish Open this weekend. We have to mention Kevin Killeen. He managed to win the high roller for $38,000. It was a 2K high roller. He managed to beat Sam Warburton heads up, who is no pushover when it comes to the pokers. So congratulations to both those players. Let's have a look at our winners for the Irish Open 2017. Griffin Binger won the main event for €200,000. Congratulations to him. Moldovan Mike Mazilu came second. Local hero Chris Dowling, who gave me a hard time on day two, I have to say. The felt, he was a gentleman, but he gave me a hard time when it came to the cards. He got third, so very pleased for him. Banshee Vandaapu, I apologize if I got that wrong, I probably did. He managed to get himself fourth place. Anthony Rickett got fifth. Sumia Singh, an absolute gentleman, he got himself sixth. Fintan Han got seventh. And last year's runner-up, Michael Canardi, got eighth. Congratulations to all the final tablers. Well done, everybody.
Yes, indeed. Michael Connolly there, just to pronounce it correctly there, Ian. Incredible effort there, going back-to-back final tables. You don't see that too often in big field tournaments.
Declan Connolly is a man who's pretty good at the back-to-back final tables.
Actually, that's a good point. He's pretty good at them too. But yeah, just a little shout out for our own Espen Jorstad, who got runners up in the Heads Up tourney there at the Irish Open. Bjorn Gezaert beat former Liverpool footballer John Arne Riise Heads Up to win the JP Masters and a tasty 30k. That brings me back to our chat last week about Mr. Gardner and how good footballers are at poker. Well, obviously John Arne Riise, not to be bested. He did the biz this weekend. Thomas Harstadt won the Liam Flood Memorial Tournament for 15 grand. That's a 350 quid turbo event, as the late great Liam Flood would have wanted. You know, no deep stacks. He wanted to get his money in fast. So, you know, a perfectly apt tournament in his name. But yeah, incredible result. Like that Griffin Benger result. Like, he's just such a beast, isn't he, Ian?
He really is. You can't argue with his results. He's doing very well for himself.
Yeah, didn't ask anyone to check their privilege this week, as far as I could see. I checked the tape for that one.
Oh, well, that's an improvement then.
Yeah, really happy to see Chris Dowling, good friend of mine, get third place. He was chip leading all the way through the early days, and then obviously kind of came into the final day with one of the shorter stacks.
Yes, indeed. Third place finish for him. So how much did he bag? Do we know?
I think he got an 80 grand for that one.
Oh, lovely. Good man himself.
Yeah, not too shabby. Not too shabby for any of these guys. Credit to Pádraig Parkinson and Dara O'Carney, who provided excellent live stream commentary for that event. And I believe they will be on TV3 on Irish TV in the next couple of weeks with an edited version of that show.
Indeed. They stole all my viewers on Sunday and tonight. I actually went downstairs expecting my wife to be playing my stream, as she normally does, but no, it was Dara. And I asked her why, and she said, well, it's Dara.
So Griffin Benger, Irish Open 2017 champion, and then, like you mentioned earlier on, Sam Grafton, absolutely crushing. Those GPI commentators obviously got to watch the best players in the world play. Not that they're too shabby themselves, but they got to watch those best players in the world play for about 6 months. They've obviously picked up a thing or two.
That sounds like the trick. Maybe that's the road I have to go down, right?
Well, you know, or maybe that's the road your wife chose to go down when she watched Dara and not you tonight.
That might be it.
For the strategy section this week, I'm going to put myself on the chopping block. About, I think, a month ago, I played in the Sit and Go for the Unibet Ambassadors in London. I finished third in that. I was happy with the result. But there was a very interesting hand early on in the day when my good friend Dara O'Carney opened a min raise from the button. Very, very experienced, very accomplished online wizard, Dan Murr, 3-bet from the small blind, and I faced a slightly wonky decision with ace-queen offsuit from the big blind. I have with me in the booth, as usual, Dara O'Carney, and also Diva Burriskite-Byrne, who was on commentary that day and can hopefully maybe give me some insights, tell me what I did wrong most of all. Dara?
Yeah, so basically the hand opens with me opening, I think, king-nine on the button. It's probably at the bottom of my opening range, given that it's into the two best players on the table.
Oh, stop it.
Well, the best player on the table, small blind anyway, but also a player who knows a lot about my game on the in the big blind and won't necessarily give me the same respect that some of the other players at the table might.
Uh-oh.
So the worst hand I open, and then I get 3-bet from Dan Murr, who obviously I know is a really accomplished online player. So he can be super wide here, but at the same time, he had played relatively tight, I think, up to this point in the event. So he 3-bets, and I'm kind of losing interest in the hand already. And then you went deep into the tank, and you were thinking for a long time, and I was curious as to what hand you had and what your decision process was.
Yeah, from my position, ace-queen offsuit, I guess I had all the options available to me. I could fold, I could flat call, I could 3-bet large, I could 3-bet smaller, or I could even just shove all in. Now, importantly in this hand, the stack size is, as always, stack size very important in a hand. Dara, you were opening 38 bigs, roughly.
That's right, yeah, I think at 23K, so yeah, 38 bigs exactly.
Dan was playing about 50 bigs from the small blind, and I had both of you covered. But it was going to be for a huge amount of my stack. I think I might have been playing 70 bigs or so.
Yeah. And even though it's early in the sit and go, obviously ICM is always a factor in the sit and go, so that factors in somewhat as well.
Yeah, so with your raise to 1,200, Dan's 3-bet to 3,800, I had the option, as I said, to call, to fold, to maybe 3-bet to something like 8,400, which would be on my kind of smaller size, or actually that would be kind of a medium size. I guess I could do one of those old school clicks to maybe 6,000, something like that. Or indeed, I could just put it all in and just, you know, take my equity, just hope that nobody has a better hand. In most worlds, I imagine that was going to get through. Now, I ran through all the options in-game, ultimately decided on a really, really boxy fold, which I, in retrospect, don't hate, but we ran that through a simulator, and it came out with some results which ad nauseam amount of calculations, it came out with results, but the result it came out with was the one that Diver had actually instinctively come to on commentary.
One of the interesting things about the hand is, while you were thinking about the hand and deciding what to do, and I was wondering what you had, Diver obviously knew exactly what you had since she was in the commentary booth, and she gave her opinion on what you should do, which Diver might share with us now.
Yeah, well, I was watching at the time and commentating with Mark Conway. So my thought process was like that Dara is opening around 70% of his hands on the button. So then Romanian guy, Dan Moore, he 3-bets from small blind, regardless of seeing the hand. Lots of good players do that with the hand either full value or as a bluff, but also just to take the initiative in the hand and be an aggressor. But considering his results and live experience and what he's been doing that day up to then, I thought there are quite a big chunk of bluffs in his range. So coming back to you now in the big blind, you obviously face a pretty key decision, as you really playing for stacks if you 4-bet. I don't necessarily feel you can 4-bet fold to Dara.
Well, it's funny you say that. In-game, I was thinking maybe that's exactly what I could do.
You min click.
If I offered the really small sizing, maybe to 6K or 6,300, Dara coming over the top can't really be too many bluffs, I don't think. And that's why I'm not saying Dara never has a bluff there, but it's going to be heavily weighted towards value. And actually, Ace-Queen's going to be in terrible shape. Like, he might have jacks, but it's probably going to be a hand that dominates me, most likely something like Ace-King. Similarly, I thought, well, Dan is just that much looser. He plays that much more, you know, not GTO. He's trying to exploit people. So maybe it's actually an induce against him. So in my mind, I was thinking maybe this is a click where I fold to Dara, even though he is the shorter stack, and I'm inducing Dan.
Okay, that's interesting. But I guess, you were taking your time and thinking about that. And my think at the time was like that you deep enough just to call and keep Dan in because he's playing out of position with you. And your hand is too strong just to fold preflop. And I guess I didn't fancy the option of 4-betting calling, like you said.
Well, it's funny you say that. Dara ran the analysis, and a 4-bet to any size, assuming game theory optimal ranges, would have been a catastrophe. A shove would have been the worst. Any 4-bet was bad.
Probably shove, just either shove, right.
Yeah, we were so confused after the hand because we talked to a lot of really good players about it, and we got such a... Often when you ask like 10 good players about a hand, 7 or 8 of them will have the same opinion and 1 or 2 won't. But this literally was all over the place. Some people felt that you should 4-bet small. Some people felt that you should 4-bet bigger. Some people felt that you should shove. Some people felt, as Diver did, that calling was the best option. I don't think we found anybody else who advocated folding, but
Just a coward like me advocated folding.
But I did ask you what you thought your second best option was, and you said possibly to raise a bit bigger and maybe fold to me and continue against Dan. So I ran this bot assuming that Dan had the GTO ranges, let's say, and the surprising result for me was that raising any amount is unprofitable, and the more you raise, the worse it is. So if you are going to raise, let's say the least mistake you can make is clicking it, making the smallest raise possible.
Yeah, that's what you had in mind, right?
Absolutely, but, and there is a big but with this.
Yeah, the best play by far is the flat call, as Diver had advocated on commentary. However, as a provisor to that, when you actually break down Dan's ranges, he's not actually supposed to have 8-7 suited in there. So if he always has 8-7 suited, and we don't know that, maybe he just sometimes 3-bets 8-7 suited randomly. But if he always has 8-7 suited and hands of that equal value in there, then that suddenly makes raising a much better prospect because he has so many weak hands. And all the raising options now become more profitable.
With the shove actually being the most profitable.
Yeah. And the shove is the best option of all because he just has to fold so much.
That was my think at the time. I think first option was just the flat and the second one just the jam.
Well, I'm going to be completely honest here and explain my thought process, and I totally own any criticism of this. In game, I felt like, well, hand on heart, and I know Victor Blom was there in the game, and he's obviously a ridiculously superb high-stakes nosebleed cash game player. But in game, in a sit-and-go, I felt like Darrow Carney and Danmer were probably the two best players in that format.
Yeah.
And I thought, getting into a spot for all my chips against these two guys in this situation, 7 left, 8 left, whatever it was, is probably a dicey situation at best. I'm going to find better spots. Ian Simpson's at the table, remember. There's soft money to be won. I really felt as though, you know, while Ian's here, I can't be taking any high variance lines. So what I felt hand on heart was I can call and take your option diver, which I think maybe in retrospect I will do now in future. I think that is probably the better line. And just trust my post-flop skills even against the two best players there. But in the moment I just thought, you know what, discretion is the better part of valor. I make this big fold here, life goes on, I get to play some different pots with some weaker opponents hopefully and maybe progress through the tournament.
Yeah, I think that's very good looking at the bigger picture, let's say. Even if calling can be profitable, and I think I remember talking to you immediately after the hand, and you said the thing you didn't like about calling was that if you call, then I pretty much have to call given the price, and now you're playing out of position to me, and Dan is the aggressor in the hand, so you're kind of squeezed between the two of us. So there can be cases where discretion is the better part of valor, and I mean you did end up coming third in that second go and cashing. So
results for the win, we'll take that. Well, look, thank you very much, guys. I really appreciate your feedback.
Welcome.
We're joined today by John Spinks, MS Bass, LUFC Bass, the Nappy Fund, amongst other online monikers. 2.7 million plus in online winnings, 750,000 in live earnings, and I reckon unspeakable cash earnings over the years as well. John, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
That was probably the best intro we've given anyone.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that to do with the caliber of player? Or
it's to do with the fact that you're our first guest.
Fair enough. I'll take it.
No, sincerely welcome to the show. You are a man from Brighton or lives in Brighton?
So I moved to this neck of the woods about six years ago now, roughly. I've never really left.
Great stuff. And a family man these days?
Yep, two little monkeys. Very much family man.
Great stuff. Well, look, I'm going to start with your early career, if you don't mind. I first met you in 2009, I think it was, in Barcelona.
Yeah, I was trying to work this one out, actually. It's got to be at least 7 or 8 years ago now, I reckon, it's at least.
Definitely. I remember we had a mutual friend in Jono Crute, and Jono introduced us in Barcelona, and I think I might have knocked you out of that tournament. That's not the point of this story, but I think I did bust you.
It's definitely true, and I remember being really pissed off, so congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
Well done bringing that up.
Look, in 2009 I met you for the first time. That was a lovely time in Barcelona, but you were already sort of crushing the world at that stage online. You were killing it, moving up through the ranks. You had quite a nice posse of pals you used to travel together. Who was in your group back then?
So basically, because I didn't travel right at the start, I had all my success was online. And then I traveled with John Eames was the guy that first got me on the circuit, basically. And then I met Jake, Cody, Matt Perrins, Dominic Niche. To be honest, I can't even remember who else there was. But that was the core of what I'd say my close travel buddies, let's call them.
Yeah, I remember when I first met John Eames, he told me that he had a 300% ROI playing live. So I'm guessing it was a sales pitch, something like that, that maybe got you to leave the computer for the first time.
I think it was more just curiosity. I was pretty comfortable just playing online. Like, it's, you know, I'm a very much a home person. But I wanted to explore whilst I was still young and all of that kind of stuff.
And I guess the pinnacle of that, although I know you travelled all over, was that World Series in 2011 when you made two final tables, I think two fourth place finishes in the same week?
Yeah, they're maybe not the same week. It was a week apart, I think. That was great. 2011 was kind of when I, let's say, peaked. I had really successful online results for the start of 2011. I think I was like number one on Full Tilt OPR and stuff. It was crazy times. I just went to the World Series and just something clicked in that. I think that was within the first 2 weeks of the whole series. Like, it was, I think I got maybe two top 15 places as well on top of that, and a couple of other deep runs. So it was really a really crazy series, and nothing really compares ever to that run of those like 6-7 weeks.
And did you feel at that point that you had a massive skill edge, let's say, over the typical W World Series player, or do you think it was mostly run good?
Over the stereotypical World Series player in 2011, sure. As a general person, I've never really rated myself as being good. I would say I'm quite realistic in that sense. Maybe we could call it pessimistic, but I've always just tried to be better than most people, as opposed to I've never strived to be the best, which sounds pretty pathetic when I think about it, but I've just always, and that's why I think I was so successful before, because I base myself on making fewer mistakes than everyone else, as opposed to trying to outplay any of that kind of stuff. I was purely focusing on make less mistakes, play solid, everyone else will just mess up.
Okay, but what you're saying right now and what I'm hearing are exactly the things that made you a bit of a role model for me when I was starting out. Like, I was only playing the game a few years. You were, you know, that next tier above me, and, you know, someone I was familiar with. You always were the model of somebody who was, like, mistake-free. You know, you mightn't have been the most creative player, you mightn't have been taking the crazy lines, but you were just like the rock. And by rock, I don't mean like an old school nit. I mean, you were just like really solid and you just played like error-free poker.
Error-free poker maybe going a bit too far, but for 2009 to 2011, sure, in comparison to others, definitely much fewer errors. You wouldn't see any kind of tilt out of me or anything like that, realistically, like from like... I think I was very mature with poker from a really young age.
Like, yeah, definitely. I remember, like, I would say that the way you approached the game spoke to me totally, because it was like, here's somebody who's going to have longevity, and here's somebody who, in most possible worlds, will do really well. You know, you see a lot of guys, and they've got those crazy games, and, you know, of their time, sometimes that was the best game to have. That was the game that would win you the most money, maybe win you life-changing money over a year. But you played in a style that was going to be successful, regardless of run good, regardless of individual results.
I was pretty close friends with Jono Cluth, and I used to hang out with Jono, and I know you were a massive role model for Jono, and for players of his sort of generation coming up. And I think it was that sort of like very, very professional approach that you took to the game, very, very solid. I mean, I know Jono wouldn't mind me saying, but he pretty much idolized you. His screen name was a homage to you. Were you aware of the fact that you were seen as sort of a role model for, let's say, the next generation down?
Yeah, I mean, especially with regards to Jono, I definitely know that I took him under my wing from a very early point in his career. So for that, I was aware of that, and I put a lot of time, and I even put money into him and stuff. Like, I really watched him progress. Yeah. And then watched him surpass me.
Your biggest result came in February 2013. I think you won the 2K in Deauville for 140K. That must have been a pretty tasty big bink there.
Yeah, that was... Wow, is it really that long ago? Yeah.
We're old people.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Deauville's been pretty much my best stomping ground. I mean, as far as results go, it was only that, and I think I cashed a high roller there or something before. But the year before I won that one, I chopped like a full tilt multi-entry Sunday 100 rebuy for like 100 grand or something. And nice. I think it was the exact same day, physical day, I did that. 1 year later, I then won the 2K. So I missed Oval. It was a good place. but yeah, I'd never really had any wins by that point, I don't think, live. I think that may have been like, it was certainly my first notable victory. Mm. There's no prestige in it, because it's just a 2K side event. Like, the money and everything is incredible, but there wasn't any prestige in it. I literally, you know, I won the money. I went to the cashier, and I literally... Me and John Eames went home that, like, straight from that, went straight home, just went to go over the crossing, and that was that. It was richer and just left.
Nice.
So there was no partying, no excitement, just, I guess it's my way, it's always been, just get the money and run. Like.
Yeah. Well, you said, like, 2011 was, like, the peak of your powers, maybe, but at the same time, 2013, you recorded your two biggest results, that one in Deauville, and then online, you won the warm-up.
Yeah, it's been so long since I won. You're really bringing back the memories. Yeah, that one was really weird because I'm pretty certain when it was in, was it like, it was in late October,
November, yeah.
November. Yeah, because things had been really pretty tough and I was expecting my
first. Need a baby on the way, yeah.
Expecting my first. I'd found out a few months before that. Suddenly to just come away with six figures came at a really decent time for me. It was incredible. I literally left the next week to go on holiday to the Caribbean, got engaged, bought an expensive ring, lost all my money.
You mentioned your wife, Kat, there. Kat used to work as a poker dealer.
Yeah. Probably started doing that at the same time, roughly.
Yeah, I think I actually met Kat before I met you. What did you learn about the experiences of a full-time dealer from her, and did it change your perspective on how the industry runs?
Yes. I don't want to be too critical of the employers of dealers and stuff like that, but I witnessed a lot of awful stuff. I don't want to talk from like a personal point of view, but the way that the staff got treated in general was shocking back then. I have no kind of contacts these days to know what, but the stuff that I heard, specific companies, like big events, the way that they got treated, the hours, I mean, the hours are just, without breaks, are awful at a lot of these events. The way that female dealers get treated at the table, the lack of protection they get from the staff, all of that kind of stuff. And quite frankly, I turned around to her and said, I really think it's for the best if you move away from this industry for your own sake. It also opened my eyes to the way women in general, like, I don't want to make this some big...
No, work away, because this is a really important topic, yeah.
But for me, it was a big eye-opener to the way women are treated and how we should treat women in just in general. And you know, just being a white middle-class male, you don't really get to appreciate how tough it can be. And so for me, it was a huge eye-opener into the industry, the other side of the industry, and also a lot of life lessons from it.
Yeah, and I'm sure those issues you're referring back to, I'm sure it's still going on. You know, it's certainly, whether it's dealer abuse at the table, okay, that's the players. You're also talking about the companies who hired the staff, overworking them, not treating them well, maybe not putting them up in good places. You know, without the dealers, there's no poker. You, like, everybody, every cog in the poker machine needs to, you know, be looked after and maintained and have its appropriate amount of value assigned to it, because without all these people, you know, there's nothing.
I came into poker pretty late. I mean, I'd basically worked in the industry outside of poker for 20 years before I became a poker player. And for me, it was like going back in time. It was a real shock to see the way women were treated in poker. And it felt, you know, it felt really anachronistic. I thought there was almost no other area where this would be tolerated. That said, I do think it has improved over the years, because I think the culture is getting more mature, and also more male players realize that it's their responsibility to kind of go out on a limb when somebody's being a dick at the table.
Yeah, I think people share your attitude, John. I think, you know, most young players growing up now, you know, have strong female influences, and just it's not like they have to correct their behavior. They just don't have that behavior to begin with.
I think that's the biggest thing, is the percentage of players that have that behavior in them is far smaller. Certainly, I see far less of it from a distance. Saying all that, it definitely can still be improved. But then again, it can in society. So I don't want to be like, oh, poker's so bad for this, when in reality, society's still got a long way to go.
Sure. And what year did you meet Kat? Because if you sort of started up in the game at similar times, was it instantaneous, or did you sort of, you know, did she deal your table a few times in a row and suddenly it was like, oh, hey?
Well, I'm going to get in big trouble if I don't remember this. So I first met her at UK IPT Brighton 2010. Yeah, straight after Vegas. I flew from Vegas and played it off, and I was jet lagged the entire time. I didn't sleep for about 72 hours. I got fifth, I think, in the end. I fell asleep at the table twice, but I met her.
What a catch, you must have been thinking.
Yeah. To be fair, I met her at the payout, so, you know.
Okay.
But no, that we only, she didn't, to be fair, she doesn't even remember that, but it was then Deauville the following year. So
you made no impression the first time.
I think that's a fair assessment, and I'm still doing well on that regard. So, but yeah, I think we first actually started getting talking in Deauville 2011, it will have been. And I think it was at the table, I met her, and she was trying to speak French in numbers, and I made a joke because she was messing up the numbers on one of them. And bless her, she for some reason she then asked for my number to meet up for drinks later, you know, with all the dealer crew and stuff. And
did you give her those numbers in French?
Oh no, I'm allowed to critique her French numbers, but I wasn't the hottest. But yeah, I mean, we just traveled the circuit. I kind of went to, it was purely platonic for a good 5 or 6 months.
But there was something there. Well, clearly, yeah. Deauville was your best location for poker.
Of course, in
every respect.
Now you've reminded me, if we can edit this out. my best poker moment was Deauville 2011, because I met Gaff.
Right, we'll just put that in at the beginning there.
Just loop it.
Get rid of all the rest.
Ignore the money. Go back. And
So it was obviously a romance blossomed, and a few years later, engagement, kids have obviously, they change everything. I've really brought you in today because I'm expecting, and I want some tips on how you do the dad poker player balance.
Well, I can give you tips for the dad part, but the poker player, not so much these days. It's a very, very tough balance, actually. The good news is the second one's a lot easier, generally, and you get used to it. You get used to the lack of sleep, actually having to wake up a proper time of the day and stuff like that. I'm not up late in the 7 a.m. most days anymore, but if you said that to me 3 years ago, I'd have literally gone, well, I've only just gone to bed.
I think a lot of people find, when they do have families, not to be too despairing for David here, but they do find it very difficult to adjust. I mean, I came into poker much later and my kids were essentially grown up. I'm not sure I would have been able to do it when they were young.
Yeah, that was a good strategy, actually, in retrospect. So do you feel like it's much more likely you'll transition to a new career now? Poker will become a pastime that you're just quite good at and going to probably still do quite well at a social level? Or do you think it's still a career in poker?
I mean, I've kind of always put a silly limit on myself, saying when I'm 30, I want to have a plan B. I've got everything from a personal level that I could ever want. I own a house, I've got my children, I've got a loving partner. All of that side of it is covered. So now from a professional level, it's about where I want to go from here. I took some time out from poker last year and went out into the real world and worked for 3 months before my son was born. But then I decided to just quit that and enjoy being at home with my son for the first 3 months. But realistically, within the next 18 months, I think I will find a transition out of poker, realistically. It's still easy to enjoy as a hobby, I think, but for me, the hours that it requires and stuff, it's...
And what do you feel are the skill sets that poker brought that you can transition into something else, or do you think just scrap that, something completely different?
It's not so much... I mean, poker brings everything with regards to... You know, when I sat down and write my CV and I'm sitting there going, what has poker brought me? The list is endless. It's honestly endless. How many other people have to organize all of their own travel whilst also doing all of the study of statistics, mathematical analysis, psychological issues, emotional issues. It's so multi-layered, poker is. There's so much more to it. The ability to work ridiculously long hours, putting in the effort, there's so much to it, and it translates so easily to the workplace. If anything, it's the problem is finding people to truly appreciate your level of ability, and that's the thing I found the hardest whilst I was searching. Is, you know, it's very hard to write on a piece of paper all of this stuff and them to be like, well, that makes you more qualified than the guy that's been selling ice creams or whatever. You know, it is very hard. It's still in a day and age where that's an issue. I mean, there was one. I actually applied to be a call handler for the police for 999 calls and stuff. I got all the way to the end. I'd passed all of the tests easily. It wasn't even challenging. It's multitasking questions and stuff. And I'm sitting there going, I finished with half the time left and everyone else is start. But it gets to the end in the final interview and I got put with two people that had absolutely no idea about poker. And I honestly believe that's what cost me the job in comparison to, because it was impossible for them to understand the correlation. As much as I can sit there and explain it, it's still viewed in a different way to a traditional job, let's say. As I said, I even had work experience at this point as well. But the transition, and that's one of the things I think for poker players that haven't thought about their plan B, if you're thinking you're getting towards the end, that now is the time to take action.
Yeah, a lot of the younger players I know, it seems like their plan B is just kind of a vague, oh, well, I'll start a business, and they haven't really put much thought into what that is or how difficult it is. And I definitely agree with your point that it's very hard to communicate what the benefits of all the work you've done in poker are to real-world employers. I mean, there's just general, even misunderstanding of poker in the general populace. Like I felt it the other way because I came from outside of poker into poker, and particularly from running, when I came from running, when all my running friends just couldn't understand what I was doing playing poker. For them, it was just mindless gambling. And I think, unfortunately, that's what a lot of people think when they think poker.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. I mean, a lot of interest in interviews I've had and stuff. I wouldn't say there's overall been a lot of negativity, a lot of interest, which has been nice. But it's still not enough to necessarily understand the positive parts of it. I mean, of course, like with everything, there's some negative stuff. Like, for example, in the police thing, they ask you to show signs of selflessness and stuff. It's like, how can I show that through my job as a professional poker player? My job is to take your money. Like, I'm not going to be selfless, am I, in that instant? And so that instantly was like probably a big no-no, because I was just like, you've got to be honest in these situations. You've got to be like, well, I can't show it from a professional point of view, straight from a personal level. You know, I have children, I care for these people, I spend my life looking after them.
And what you do with the money when you take it off, mercilessly take it off somebody else, you then put it to good use. Your story, in a sense, gives me a huge amount of hope, because when you see the young gun, the young kind of hotshot pro beating the world, and there's plenty of the 21, 22 year old guys out there now doing that, you worry about them. You kind of think to yourself, oh, that's a big kind of bright flame that could go out kind of soon, and will they have anything to show for it at the end? Will they have a real legacy of what those years meant or did for them in terms of their life moving forward? But also, you know, like, are they happy? Like, are they going to live a normal life? Like, for me, it's lovely seeing people go have a normal, like, settle down, have kids. Like, that's the dream. Surely when poker facilitates you having a lovely normal life, that's the dream, and that's a great success story in the game. For me, that's the real success story. Thank you so much, John. From Dara and I know we're thrilled to have you on.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, John.
Playing us out tonight is a brilliant Dublin-based folk rock quartet whose music is available on Spotify and SoundCloud. Big thank you to Joe, Oisin, Liam and Cian. It's true I'm a sucker for a band name with a poker connotation. This is Heroes in Hiding, and No, You're a Rabbit.
My mind, and I
Todd, Diva and John. Next week our guests will be 2015 GPI Media Person of the Year Mark Convey and Irish poker legend Porrick Parkinson. Until then, from Dara, Ian and myself, good night and good luck.